Welcome back. This is Ask the Compound, the show where Duncan reads the questions directly to you, from you, and he only gets annoyed if it take up more than one page.
It's true.
Fair?
Yeah.
Every week I get more and more impressed with the depth and breadth of the questions that we get. We have a very educated audience, because sometimes to ask the right questions, you have to be educated enough to know what to ask. Very knowledgeable set of viewers here. Remember, askthecompoundshow@gmail.com is our email address. Today's show, we'll be discussing questions straight from you about having a dedicated allocation to cash in your portfolio. Will I sign off on that? Pros and cons of paying off your mortgage early and then taking some money out via home equity, donating stock to charity for a tax break, quantifying the tax advantages of ETFs versus mutual funds, and then striking the right balance between traditional and Roth accounts and diversifying your tax base. Also, don't forget to sign up for the Compound newsletter, where each day you will get an alert straight from Duncan's brokerage account about which stocks to pick. I'm kidding. You won't get that. But you will get a weekly wrap-up of all our Compound content in case you missed it, all the shows, podcasts, blogs.
You know, that newsletter would be a lot of fun, honestly.
It actually kind of would.
It could be
my contra.
Yeah.
Announcements, live event updates, new merch drops. You can check all the stuff from idontshop.com. Know who the next TCAF guest is going to be a week in advance. Go to thecompoundnews.com to sign up and learn more. All right. Questions. Welcome everyone in the live chat as always. We always appreciate it. All right.
Also, thanks for everyone writing reviews. You guys talked about animal spirits this week, so I figured I'd mention on this show, but we really appreciate it. We have a great rating. I think 4.7 out of 5 on Apple Podcasts. Go on there, leave us a rating. You can just do the star,
or
you can
actually write something. Is that better or worse than your Uber rating?
That's better than my Uber rating. Yeah. I think it's slightly better than my Uber rating. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let's do it.
All right. Up first today, we have Ben always shares the long run returns for stocks, bonds, and cash. It's essentially 10%, 5%, and 3%. I know past is not predictive, blah, 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 but I'm well aware that cash has the lowest prospective returns of the main asset classes. Knowing this full well, I still want to keep 10% of my portfolio in cash in retirement so I can sleep at night. Would a 60-30-10 portfolio really be that much worse than a 60-40?
I like this question because it gets down to the idea of optimization versus behavior, right? I always say emotions always win out over spreadsheets, which is, I think, why understanding those lesser parts of yourself is so important as an investor. So Ron here is right. Cash does have the lowest prospective return. Even if T-bill yields are high right now and cash has done okay lately, over the long run, cash is probably still your worst option. So I have no problem with a behavioral release valve like this in your portfolio as long as you understand the trade-offs. So I have reviewed the returns, as he mentioned, for stocks, bonds, and cash over the long run. But let's look at this over a closer time period. So what I did is I looked at the 60-40 portfolio. This is U.S. only, S&P 500, 10-year treasuries, and then three-month T-bills for cash. And I looked at a 60-40 portfolio and then a 60-30-10. So 60% stocks, 30% bonds, 10% cash, and I rebalanced these annually. And I showed these returns through the end of 2023 going up back the last 10, 20, 30, and 40 years. Actually, the last 10 years, having cash would have done better than bonds, slightly, a couple basis points, because bonds had such a nasty bear market. Over the last 20 and 30 and 40 years, you would have been better in that 60-40 portfolio without the cash. But it's not like a market difference, right? We're talking basis points here, 10, 20, 15, 30 basis. Even over 40 years, we're talking a 30 basis point difference between having 10% in cash. So it's really not as bad as you would think. So bonds have had higher returns, and bonds have had really good returns over the last 20, 30, and 40 years. Even if the past 10 years, it hasn't been very good. So you give up a little bit return. That's the trade-off, but then you can sleep it. So John, throw up the next one. I just did a quick growth of $10,000 in each of these over the past 40 years. And you can see the lines pretty much track each other for the first while there, and it doesn't really break out until more recently. So yeah, 60-40 portfolio got you to a higher place, but it's not a huge difference. Again, and this is over 40 years. If we're talking about retirement, you're probably more worried about 10, 20, maybe 30 years. So the gap is not as large as you would think. So I'm not a fan of going to extremes. If you're going to say, I'm going to go all into stocks, and then I'm going to go all out of stocks and into cash, and then jump back, I don't condone that type of behavior, because I just don't think it's a way to invest successfully over the long term. But if you carve out a piece of your portfolio, it's 5%, 10%, 15%, whatever it is, if that's going to allow you to leave the other 95%, 90%, 85%, whatever it is, alone, I'm fine with that. Like, the whole idea of there being a perfect portfolio for everyone is hogwash. It's, you know, it matters what you can, the optimized spreadsheet portfolio that you're not going to be able to stick with. Who cares? Pick the one that you're actually going to be able to stick with, as long as it matches your risk profile and time horizon and temperament. So I think long-term returns are the only ones that matter, of course, but you have to be able to stick with them over the short term to make it different. So I think I tweeted this out yesterday. Daniel Kahneman passed away. And in his Nobel Prize speech, he said, the reason that you can't have an exclusive focus on the long term is because the long term is not where life is lived. And I love that for investors, because you have to make it through a bunch of series of short terms to get to the long term. So if you're having a little bit of cash in your portfolio that you're going to stick with is part of your plan, I have no problem with that.
So what's considered cash exactly? I know I feel dumb asking this, but I hear people refer, it sounds like even T-bills they consider cash, and then other people are literally just talking about cash. Some people are talking about CDs.
Well, I'm like, not talking about burying cash in your backyard.
Okay.
I'm talking about yeah, cash equivalents like T-bills, CDs, money market funds, high yield savings accounts. That's the kind of stuff that I consider cash. So you're still earning a yield. It's not like it's being buried in a box, a shoebox under your mattress or whatever. It's still doing something for you. It's just the expected returns are not as high as bonds or stocks.
Okay.
So I still want to be invested in some form.
Okay, I got you.
Yes.
So yeah, I'm not literal cash in a box.
No. Duncan, what year is it? No one holds cash anymore. Gangsters, maybe. But they should be using Bitcoin at this point.
Yeah, yeah, they got to get with the times. Crypto's.
They did the Sopranos today. Tony would totally be into meme coins.
Speaking of which, I mean, do you have anything to say about SBF, the SBF news? 25
no,
years?
No, I was just, my only question to you was, how many of the holdings you have right now will you still hold by the time he gets out of jail in 2 decades?
Yeah, that's going to be zero, probably. Okay. But maybe my Oli, that would be the one if they're still kicking.
Okay. I'm gonna guess no on that, but that's just a guess. The stock is down 95% since IPO.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And that means it's a lot less expensive now, right?
All right. I like that question. Good one.
Yeah,
next question.
And that one was from Ron, by the way. Up next, we have a question from Aaron. You've already covered this a lot, but both times I've heard Ben's opinion on not paying down mortgage interest early, he's made it sound like that cash is frozen until you've paid off the entire loan. He's not mentioned that if rates come down and you refinance, you'll have the option of getting that cash back. This one's going to take some explanation from you because I don't quite understand this. My current strategy is paying down my 6.8% mortgage now with spare cash, but I'm hoping to refinance in the low fives in the next couple of years, at which time I'd pull out a few hundred K, not to brag, and put it in the market. Incidentally, this is a pretty good anecdote for demonstrating how high rates cool the market and low rates boost it. This sounds like sorcery.
All right. Well, this question reminds me of the guy in Princess Bride who's constantly switching the glasses back and forth. And I feel like Aaron is outthinking himself. So first of all, this is a topic where I told you we get questions about this all the time. Like, people will fiercely defend their side on this to the death, and no one will ever change their mind, right? Besides me, credit to me. I did change my mind on this. Our guest on today's show is coming on in a minute, helped me change my mind on this. But it helped that rates were sub 3% when I changed my mind. So fair enough point. Your money, I always say, what's the point of having it locked up in the house if it's illiquid and you can't do anything with it? You can't spend your house. Aaron here is saying, no, I can pull it out if I do a cash out refi or a home equity line of credit, right? I can pull that money out. I'm putting it in and then I can pull it right back out because I've paid it down and then I cash out refi and I borrow the difference. Fair enough. John, do a chart on here. This is home equity over the past 10 years this country has gone from a little bit over $11 trillion to $33 trillion almost. We've added more than $20 trillion in home equity in the past 10 years alone. So I think when mortgage rates fall, we're going to see a massive spike in home equity lines of credit and cash out refis. That money is just trapped right there now because home prices are up so much, but mortgage rates are too high to borrow against it. So when those rates fall, people are going to pull that money out to do renovations or take trips or speculate on crypto, whatever it is. People aren't just going to let the money sit there. No rabbit hole here, but the thing is, why do you want to pay your mortgage off early if you're just going to pull the money back out to invest it anyway? The whole time value of money says invest your money now. Investing your money now in the market is better than investing into the future because you can earn gains on it. You can earn returns. You can compounding. So why don't just use that spare cash to invest now as opposed to borrowing against your house and paying a rate of interest to then invest it in the future? You're taking an extra step that's unnecessary. Just invest it now, not in the future.
Is time value the same thing as net present value?
Time value of money is just the fact that a dollar to me now is worth more because I can invest it than a dollar in the future.
Okay.
Because you can earn a rate of interest or invest it in the stock market. My whole point is that you lose out on a lot of flexibility by paying off your mortgage. Because what if it takes longer for you to hit that refi target rate? He says, well, when it gets back to 5%, I'll refinance. What if it takes longer than you think? That's the problem. You lose the flexibility. I mean, this may be splitting hairs here. And maybe we've kind of wrung this one out a little bit. There's not much else to talk about here, but I wanted to defend my honor here. And I just prefer to keep it simple as opposed to overthinking it. To saying, well, I'll put the money in my house now, then I'll pull it out in the future and then invest. Just invest now. Investing now makes more sense. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. David in the chat asks, what's the time value of Bitcoin?
I got it. It's infinite, right?
Well, that's an interesting question. What do you think the price of Bitcoin will be when Sam Bankman-Fried gets out of jail?
Oh, that's a good question. So we can try to manipulate it again? I don't know. All I know is when he does get out of jail, he's going to run another scam on someone.
Do you think he has a lot in cold storage somewhere? Like he's going to get out of jail and just be like an instant billionaire with his crypto holdings?
I hope they found it. I don't know.
We'll see.
I'm not a fan.
We'll find out.
All right, next question.
Okay, up next we have a question from Jonathan. My wife works for a publicly traded tech company. This is a cool question. I like this. My wife works for a publicly traded tech company and is able to purchase discounted stock through their employee stock purchase plan. I've heard you guys reference more than a couple of times that the smart thing to do is sell the stock and get those funds into a low-cost ETF. I learned from another podcast recently, so they're cheating on us, the benefit of donating stocks to a charity directly and capturing the benefit of no capital gains tax and income tax deduction of the value of the stock at the time of donation. My new strategy for this account, $150,000 and growing, is to hold this stock. What'd you say?
Not to brag.
Not to brag, yeah. Is to hold this stock until we enter our philanthropic era and begin distributing accordingly. Any downside to this plan? That's a question. Any downside to this plan? Are there any other rules that apply? For what it's worth, we're 37 and 36 years old in a high cost of living area with two little ones, $460,000 of household income, $2.9 million of net worth, and we own our home, $1 million of equity with a 2.875% interest rate. Not to brag again. Wow.
Not to brag. Yeah, right, this one has Bill Sweet written all over it. Let's get him in here. Mr. Roth IRA himself.
Gentlemen.
Bill, I don't think we've talked about donating stock before. Before we get into this one.
Yeah.
Does my prepaying mortgage thing make sense to you?
Yeah, I'm into it. Yeah, I think it's good advice, Ben. There's a liquidity preference, and you articulated it well.
That's it. Okay. First of all, what do we think about the strategy here of donating this stock? Does this make sense for this person as opposed to trying to sell it off and diversify?
Yeah, this is a bunch of different questions in one. I'm surprised Duncan didn't ask what an ESPP is, employee stock purchase.
I know that one.
Oh, great, great. Yeah. Great, brought it. It's a really neat opportunity to buy company stock at a discount. Would I recommend donating stock to charity to benefit from the double tax advantage that we're going to explain in a second? Absolutely, Ben. I think it's a great idea. Great concept.
Okay. So what kind of tax breaks are we talking about here?
Yeah, so ESPP is a plan that allows you to buy company stock at a discount with a really, really neat look-back period. And to elaborate on describe what this is, John, can we chart this first chart up? So I'm down with ESPP, and the reason is that at worst, Ben, you get a 15% discount for buying your stock through a company plan. And it's really neat. It's a tax-qualified plan. You can't just do this infinitely. But to describe what's going on, if you sign up for one of these, there's an open period to start, a closed period, usually 12 months later, sometimes 24 months. And then there's accumulation period. And what you're opting to do is buy company stock through payroll deduction at up to a 15% discount. So the illustration that I've laid out here tries to explain it. So let's just say, hypothetically, share price of this tech company is $100. You can buy that stock for $85, meaning that the second that you buy it with your first payroll deduction, you just got $15 extra on a per share basis. You need to sign up for this over 12
every time period. Duncan buys Oatly, it goes down 15%. He just buys it the next day for 15% discount.
Yeah, sounds Duncan like a buys sale. It at a 40% premium, right? Because the share price drops by 40% immediately after. So Duncan has the opposite of the Midas touch.
Well, hold on, can we just, if we're going to, hold on, we can't just fire off shots like that without mentioning the fact that OV is actually up almost 7% today last summer.
So. Wow. Right. So you're now down how much?
40%.
94.
Better than the stock itself, though.
Yeah. This is not an Oatly podcast. So back to the chart for a second, John. So ultimately, what you're doing is you're signing up for a year's worth of purchases. And Ben, I want to talk about next the really neat thing, which is a look back, in that you get to buy the stock, like I said, for the lower of the current market price at a 15% discount, or the low of the open period, or in some cases, the close period too. And so it gives you a lot of optionality. And you can't know what the share price is going to be for a year hence. But I think at a minimum, you're getting a 15% kind of nug there. And in this case, this makes a lot of sense to me. So John, can we chart this off?
So what happens when you actually donate it then?
So you need to fast forward.
You're donating it at market value, not cost?
Yeah, exactly. And so that's the nice thing about it. So the taxes are kind of complicated. That discount that you accumulate along the way, that ends up getting taxed at ordinary income when the closing period ends. And then you get the stock in an account. And Ben, to answer your question, yes, any capital appreciation up to that point, if you donate it, you're going to get to write that off. And you don't have to pay tax on it. The charity doesn't have to pay tax on it. It's a win-win. The only people that lose are the folks at the IRS.
So you think, as far as it, so they talked about getting this philanthropic phase, which good for them that they're doing this.
I think it was an era, Ben. Let's be very clear. We just exited the Sam Bankman-Fried era, and we're entering the philanthropic era, which I'm into.
Yeah, well, good for them. This is something we probably don't talk about enough in terms of charitable giving, especially with people who write in to us often have plenty of money. So good
very,
for them.
Very cool.
Is there a better way to give to charity? Do you think this is one of the best ways to do it?
Yeah, I really do. I think the only thing that beats this, Ben, is a QCD, a qualified charitable distribution from an IRA. However, you have to be 70 and a half to do that. And I think along the way, this makes a lot of sense because it will allow them to basically leverage the portfolio effect from a company stock, right? So these folks are well off in the world. So congratulations. That's wonderful. Not to brag for them. And they're thinking about ways that they can, you know, benefit, change the world. And I think that's great. And if they get a tax break along the way, again, I think everybody wins except for the U.S. taxpayer, which is all of us as a collective. But that's okay.
Are all charities equipped to handle stock donations?
No, is the answer. So I was a trustee at the Tuxedo Park Library, and we were, because I opened up a Vanguard account to accept securities. But there's a neat way to do this, Duncan. That's through a donor-advised fund, and we can do a whole episode on that. But it's basically a conduit that allows you to donate stock to a charity, and then ultimately you can then transfer the proceeds post-sale to a charity. So you get all the benefits. The charity gets cash.
I was thinking a lot of small charities might not be set up to be able to. Yeah.
Bill, hopefully they gave you free books for doing that for the library.
Yeah. It was a great gig, by the way, in Tuxedo Park. Shout out to Diane Loomis, still the director there. Great gig. But no, I think this is a great opportunity to help. And ultimately, it, like I said, it's a great way to leverage net worth in the world, especially, like you said, for high income taxpayers.
Yeah, good for them. All right, next question.
All right, up next, we have a question from Ryan. I understand why ETFs are more tax efficient than mutual funds, but how can I quantify the value of that? For example, Fidelity has FZROX, which is a total U.S. market fund that has no expense ratio, or I can get an ETF like ITOT for 3 bips. See, I know finance stuff. The way I'm thinking about it is looking at historical capital gain distributions from FZROX and using that for my math, but would welcome a second opinion. I don't quite understand what they're getting at here, so I'm looking forward to this.
They're trying to quantify how much that tax efficiency is worth in an ETF versus a mutual fund. So should I switch from a mutual fund to an ETF? How much am I really saving there every year? And I think I want to talk about this in terms of stock versus bond ETFs too, Bill. Let's start with stocks. How do you try to quantify this?
Yeah, so let's just do a quick explainer. So capital gains distributions usually occur, Ben, late in the year, usually around December. And the idea is your sort of traditional 5-ticker mutual fund. The way that I can tell if this is capital gains eligible or not is it at 5 tickers instead of 3 or 4. Those types of funds, they need to distribute up to 90% of their capital gains and income throughout the year. If they do not do this, Ben, what happens is this double taxation situation. The fund itself is tax exempt, because it's owned by the mutual collective owners. And if they choose not to distribute capital gains and other distributions, the fund has to pay tax, and then you have to pay tax as well. That double taxation is what they're trying to avoid. And so what they need to do each year is sort of a count up and find out what capital gains have happened within the fund itself, right? Because a mutual fund is owning other publicly traded stocks, and they need to distribute that in a distribution to investors.
Wouldn't you say that an index fund is the best case scenario, though, for a mutual fund? An active fund, if there's a choice between an active fund, or active mutual fund, or an active ETF, mm-hmm. you want to choose the ETF because you don't want to get stuck with those capital gains distributions.
Yeah, but Ben, you said something really important. An index fund is not necessarily an ETF, right? You can have a 5-ticker mutual fund that follows an index. Index funds tend to be less volatile. They tend to have less turnover, and therefore they tend to have less capital gains. But an S&P 500 following a 5-ticker mutual fund can have massive capital gains distributions because what happened, this typically happens when there's downdrafts in the portfolio. If the market decreases and investors start pulling money out, in order to make redemptions in cash, the fund needs to raise cash by selling. And so paradoxically, in years like 2022 was the most recent one, when you saw investment drawdowns, the fund needs to generate cash. It needs to generate capital gains. And at the end of the year, investors who have not sold out are left holding the bag. I made a chart of what this looks like. It's bad, guys. It's BAD bad. You don't want to get a capital gains
distribution. I always hate seeing a bad formation.
From a 5-ticker mutual fund.
It gets back to the whole thing of ETFs are better for deferring your taxes until later, right?
Yep. And so let's talk about why. And so what we've been talking about is a 5-ticker fund. An ETF has this really neat tax loophole that each fund applies for when they go through their fund registration process. Details are really complicated, but basically the ETF can go to the market and say, hey, I have low basis NVIDIA stock at $1. I'm going to swap this out, right, to someone else on the market, and I'm going to, through the create redeem process, and I'm going to get a bunch of NVIDIA stock at market value. And that step-up process, if the fund manager is smart, they're doing that throughout the year. Vanguard has this neat thing where they're able to pass through mutual funds, they're able to pass capital gains to an ETF, which can then step it up, and that's a patented process. So, but the ETF has this opportunity, whereas a 5-ticker mutual fund doesn't. And so in general, whereas F0, I think, is the fund that that John mentioned, that fund hasn't had a lot of capital against distributions, it probably will in the future. And so the question is, when do you want to pay these gains? When you want to pay them, that's an ETF, or when the fund tells you you have to pay them, that's usually a 5-ticker.
Do you think the government knew what they were doing when they allowed ETFs?
No idea, right? No clue. Yeah, it just sounds good for investors. Yeah. And there could be a movement someday, a political movement, right? But ultimately,
that's what I mean. Yeah. The fact that they said, no, give us these taxes now.
Yeah, the deeper I go into tax, the more I realize that basically nobody knows what's happening here. Like everybody thinks that there's some great, this is the big thing about conspiracy theories. If you've ever worked for the government, you would realize very quickly that some grand orchestration of some sort of like conspiracy to defraud the people is impossible.
Because there is no Illuminati here.
Yeah, I don't.
That was the most interesting part of Oppenheimer, is just seeing all those different people and agencies like working together and somehow achieving their goal because— Yeah, my experience is similar where, I can't imagine they'd be able to pull something off.
Exactly. So I think in general, ETFs are the way to go for non-qualified assets. If you're in an IRA, 401k, 5-ticker funds are fine.
That makes sense. All right, we got one more.
Okay. Last but not least, we have a question from Hunt. I've been dividing my retirement contributions 50-50 between pre-tax and Roth since my 20s. So my contributions to my 401k with match, IRAs, and health savings account I'll average out so that about half of my future savings will be taxable. I don't know if this is a good strategy, but I'm sure at some point in the future I should start moving in one direction or the other. My question is, what are the circumstances or signals that I should start to contribute more one way or the other? I think this is a good question too, because I'm one of those people that has trouble figuring out how do you balance the tax benefit of lowering your income basically versus having tax-free savings for the future?
Personally, as someone who likes diversification, I like the 50-50 here. Just hedging your bets.
Yeah.
Right? It's tax diversification. I mean, maybe you can walk through some examples of when it would make sense to lean one way or the other, but I think giving yourself options makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I think, Ben, it goes back to portfolio theory. If you don't know, diversify, right? Because we don't know the proper path of events.
That was the John Bogle quote was, I keep 50% of my money in stocks and 50% in bonds. And half the time I wish I had more money in stocks and half the time I wish I had more money in bonds.
Exactly. So you're always happy or you're always sad. But yeah, I think in the absence of a clear prediction of the future, I think just diversification makes sense. And this is a layer of tax diversification. So when you get to retirement, and you're trying to project out tax brackets, let's say you have a large lump sum distribution, that would favor itself towards a type of Roth distribution, right? Because there's no tax consequences from taking a distribution there. For ongoing expenses, let's say you want to pay a rent, you have a cell phone, you want to lease a car, that lends itself to more traditional, right? Because you can plan it out at the beginning of the year, take advantage of the lower tax rates in retirement. So Ben, to kind of prepare for this, I created a chart. John, can we pull up chart number two? And the rule of thumb, this would be my rule of thumb for folks, just basic laws of taxation, the laws of Rothification, is that you would favor a Roth when you have a low tax bracket. I would define that as 22% or lower for most taxpayers. If you have a low state tax, that's another favorable point to Roth. Let's say you're in Texas, Florida, or Pennsylvania. Great, great Roth states. Long time horizon. I think Roth takes a while to pay off. It takes probably 20 to 30
great
years.
Great Roth states. I love that as like a Chamber of Commerce thing to get people to move to your state.
Exactly.
We're great for Roth IRAs.
Coming to Wyoming. Yeah, we're great for Rothification. So that would lend itself towards Roth. Where you want to be in more traditional is higher tax brackets. I would say above 32% because the jump from 24 to 32% is a large one. That's plus 8%. It happens for married taxpayers about $320,000 a year. So, you know, they're making a lot of money at that point. Higher taxes. New York, California is brutal. You probably do not want to be paying, state tax there. So therefore, you want to fund a traditional IRA or traditional 401k, which is going to allow for tax deferral. And the second thing is shorter time horizon. So I think once you enter your mid-50s, presuming an age 65-ish retirement, your time horizon is a little bit shorter. Therefore, that lends itself more to traditional. Take the tax deduction now.
Right, because that deferral is not as important to you anymore.
Exactly, because you're not going to get that back. Roth IRAs, 401ks, Roth conversions will always pay off on a long enough timeline.
I have a question based on your chart real quick.
However, just second point, on a long enough timeline, we're all dead, right? So
fair.
So therefore, it is more art than science. Duncan, you're totally right. I think you do just need to sit down and consider all the variables before you make any decisions. So Ben, what's up?
What percentage of people do you think actually know what tax bracket they're in?
I would say less than 5%. If we were to go
low, right?
Yeah, Bill walks through the street here and just ask people on 40th Avenue what their tax bracket is, my guess is very few people would come up with that.
I bet the average person would overestimate by a lot.
You think so?
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
Yeah, in the chat, it was funny. There was somebody from the UK, and I was saying, like, if you're upset about U.S. tax rates, take a look at His Majesty revenues, and custom tax service. It's well north of 50% for most taxes.
Whenever we post something – oh, yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Oh, my comment there was that the other gas prices, like, double ours.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Taxes higher, gas prices higher.
Yeah, I have the same experience in Germany where I was like, oh, these prices don't look that bad. And then I realized it was Leaders. And I was like, oh, these prices are very bad.
Yeah, okay. Half in taxes, yeah.
What I was going to say is whenever we post something like this or whenever, you know, Ben talks about this topic or you talk about this topic, someone always says, you know, I don't trust Roth because in the future the government could decide they're going to tax all that anyway. What do you say in response to that?
I mean, yeah, a lot of things could happen. There could be no United States government too, and there could be no taxes. I mean, who knows? Duncan, I don't know. I think when we sit down and plan for the future, I think it's very, very likely that the future is going to look 80 or 90% like it does today. So I think these predictions about higher tax rates in the future are valid, frankly, just because of government deficits. And certainly the government could come raid our Roths. However, those are promises made to the U.S. taxpayers. I think it's very unlikely from a political standpoint that they would come after your Roth.
You'd be grandfathered in, and it would be there would be a period of time they'd give you a window or something. I can't imagine. Nature,
yeah. Well, the IRS is going to be AI, and it's going to be very unforgiving.
It's just not a whole lot of revenue, too. I mean, Roth assets probably take up less than 20%. I'm guessing. It's pure speculation. I have no basis for that. But when I look at clients' accounts, one of the reasons I'm a Roth IRA advocate, back tattoo, back to portfolio rescue, number one, back when the show was something different, that episode, I push Roth because I very, very rarely see them, and they're so powerful in retirement, which is why, Ben, back to the premise, a 50-50 allocation, if you don't know, Ben, you're walking around, you don't know your tax bracket, that makes a lot of sense to me.
All right, Bill, I have one more question for you.
Yes, sir.
I handed you my tax stuff this week. Was that too late since April 15th is like 3 weeks away? Was I behind the eight ball this year?
No, I think you get a pass here on Good Thursday. And the primary reason is our CPA is yet to turn around our Form 1065 and K-1s. So I'm sitting waiting for that as well. So I
was waiting on you.
Yeah. Well, and I was waiting on my tax professional. So we're all waiting for someone. We're waiting for Godot. I'm waiting for Sam Bankman-Fried. He's going to be free in 2049. Duncan, what do you think he eats first? An impossible burger? Like, what does he do?
I think he's going to be eating a lot of oats and bread.
Oats, probably, he's Oatly. Right? He's an Oatly guy at that point. Yeah.
I will still be holding probably a VTI at that point.
I hope Duncan's losses.
Oh, you mean when he gets out of jail, the first thing he's going to eat?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's going to eat something like a redefined meat or chunk steak or something. You know, like, yeah, he's going to eat something really good.
Yeah. Good for him. I declare a moratorium on SBF talk because that guy just annoys the hell out of me. So if we could take a break for the next 25 years.
Fair.
I'm good with that.
Signed. I'll sign. Email us, askthecompoundshow@gmail.com. idontshop.com for all your compound merch needs. Subscribe, like, review, rate, all that stuff.
Newsletter.
Happy. Next week, all new show, joined by Nick Majuli to talk about all things sorts of portfolio stuff and personal finance questions. New compound friends tomorrow, and we will see you next time.
Tax deadline, 2.5 weeks, guys. Get those forms in.
Thanks for listening to Ask the Compound. All opinions expressed by Ben Carlson, Duncan Hill, and any of their guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Ritholtz Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for any investment decisions. Clients of Ritholtz Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.